Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Bearers of the Torch. What is the purpose of the Jewish people? What are we here for? To make great lawyers? Is that our purpose? No. Great businessmen? No. Doctors? Maybe. The word Jew comes from the word Yehuda. Yehuda comes from the word to admit, to testify. We are a witness people. We're here to bear testimony to the world about an event that occurred more than 3,300 years ago. You know, I know I'm standing in a room filled with people all over the Dallas Metroplex. You all do different things for a living, right? Some of you are very rich, like this man over here. Some of you not so. Some of you make a big salary. Some of you not so much. But, you know, if you want to make a lot of money, you start your own religion. Now, there's a lot of money. Religion business. You're not sure. Turn on the television. You'll see immediately. It's a big business. If you study all the religions that have ever existed on the face of this earth throughout all the annals of human history, you'll notice that all religions began in either of two ways. Either with a national revelation, or what is referred to as the individual revelation, meaning the claim is either God revealed himself to everyone, to the whole nation, everyone was there, or the individual revelation. God spoke to me, or he spoke to me in 8 friends, or he spoke to me in 12, but it was a defined group of people that heard it, and now you should believe it. There's only two ways all religions began. Now, if we were going to start our own religion here in this room, and we had to pick on one of those two, choose one and select one of these two methods of beginning your own religion, which one do you think sounds a little more credible? Just credibility, not plausibility, not feasibility, just on credibility. Which sounds more credible, the national or individual revelation?
National.
Clearly the national revelation, yet there's something remarkable if you study history. Look back. Because you'll find there's only one nation that ever made the claim of the national revelation, and that's the nation of Israel. And the question is why? If all of us, a bunch of Jews, are able to agree, this is a big thing, right? All the Jews are capable of agreeing that national revelation is the superior claim that you can make. So why haven't other people made the claim? And the answer is very simple. National revelation is the one claim that you cannot make unless it actually happened, unless it's actually a historical event. Imagine for a moment if we divide up Dallas area into different segments, and we start knocking on people's doors. We send out everyone, and we tell people as we knock on their doors, they open their doors, they don't slam it yet. God spoke to us in this room here today, and we have a message for you. Is it possible that some people might believe us? Yeah. It's quite possible that if we sound charismatic enough, believable enough, it's quite possible that some people might believe that God spoke to us here in this room today. But let's say we change that ever so slightly, and instead we go out and we knock on people's doors, all of us here, we divide up, some of us go to Plano, some of us go to the north, and we tell them that God today revealed himself to everyone, and this is the message. Is anyone going to believe us? No. Because they'll tell you, look, I was watching the Dallas Cowboy game, and during the commercials, nothing happened. The moment you include everyone, you immediately reveal yourself as a liar unless it actually happened. I think I've told this story. I was lecturing at Duke University. I was teaching there, and I was speaking about this, and a young man I could see in the back was going like this, nodding his head from right to left, and you could see, you know, it was a lecture, you know, when you're sitting and people in the audience are going like this, you know, it's Gahak Tzaris. This is not a good sign. It looked like he might be a Jewish fellow back there, so I said, yes, what's your problem? He said, Rabbi Singer, you have not proved a thing. Really? I said, why not? He said, isn't it just possible, he said, that the Jews thought they were having a national revelation, but they really weren't. For example, everybody knows that the Jews and the Chinese were very, very close back then. That's right, you know this, not just we eat in the restaurants, very close. And they got some gunpowder. We had bottle rockets going on from behind the mountain over there. And not only that, there are theories. There are theories out there that the ancient Hebrews have access to electricity. Did you ever hear about this? They had batteries, they had electricity, they had a speaker system going on behind the mountain. This is the Lord your God. And they were passing out a little shivas around the mountains, people a little toasted, you know, a little J&B. People were a little tsefluggin, they were a little out of it. See, they had an auditory and visual experience. This is the Lord your God, with fireworks going off, with the shivas. It's possible, he said, that they thought they were having a national revelation, but indeed, they weren't. It was, the whole thing was a hoax. So I said to him, you know, that's a very interesting point. I said, suppose that I'm Moses and you're Joshua, you're my right-hand man, and we pulled it off without a flick. Everything went perfectly. Everyone bought it. Now we're in the basement, the door is locked, we're writing our Bible. That's right. We're very excited about what went on today. And what we'll do is, we'll write in this Bible, this is a one-time event in history. Only you have been shown such an event. We'll say to people in the future, look back. Look back to all the nations that have ever existed, all the religions that have ever been. Has any other nation been seen such a thing, it heard such a thing? Only you. It's a one-time event in history. Should I do that, now that we pulled it off? And he responded immediately. He said, what? What did he say? Yeah. He said, don't do it. Why not? Why is this not a good idea? Right, because if this guy was smart enough to pull off a national revelation, then he's certainly smart enough to know that if he can do it, somebody else down the pike in 50, 100 years will do the same thing. And the moment another nation even claims a national revelation, you could throw it away in the garbage. We know that only God controls history. And then I asked him, tell me, do you have a Bible? Because he didn't, he was Jewish, so the Christian down the aisle had to pass one to him. I asked him to open up to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 4, verse 32. I asked him to read. And I just was watching his face as he was reading these words. And now, these words are a letter by the author. We don't know who wrote it. Who wrote the Bible? God, men, the committee? Is it a composite document? Is it, was it given to us at Sinai? When was it written? 3,310 years ago? 2,800 years ago? Whoever the author is, somebody wrote it. It didn't just pop out of thin air. Somebody wrote this Bible. At a certain point, it was penned. And I asked him to read this. Now, it begins by the words, Ki sha'alno liyomim rishonim. You know what that means? If you will ask about earlier times, about times that have gone past, whoever wrote this document is asking you. By the way, the word there is sha'alno. You know what no means? Please! It's an imperative. Don't sit back. Don't look at the world like a snapshot that here we are, Jews, Christians, Muslims. No. Please look back. Don't look here. Look backwards. If you want to know what happened, shall know. Please ask. Please think. That's what it means to mispalel, hispalel. What does that mean? When someone prays. What does it mean to pray? But it really doesn't mean that. Pilel. What does pilel mean? Pilel means to think. That's what it means. Anyone here know how to speak Hebrew? How do you say to dress yourself in Hebrew? Lehit lavesh, right? To cause yourself reflexive, to cause yourself to dress. Lehispalel means to cause yourself to think. That's what it really means. To think, to consider. Look back. You might inquire about times long past, going back to the time that God created man on earth, exploring one end of the heavens to the other, seeing if anything as great as this has ever happened, or if the like has ever been heard. Has any nation ever heard God speaking out of the fire as you have and still survived? Has God ever done miracles, bring one nation out of another with tremendous miracles, signs, wonders, war, and a mighty hand, an outstretched arm, and terrifying phenomena as God did for you in Egypt before your very eyes? You are the ones who have been shown. This is the words. Ata horeso lodas. You have been shown so that you might know. Interesting, the term there is das, knowledge, not faith. The word there is knowledge, not faith. You know, when we think about knowledge, what do we usually think about? Science, medicine, mathematics, things that you can prove. We think about religion, faith. What is the definition of faith, by the way, if you open up a dictionary? What is the definition of faith? Believing in something without adequate evidence, without empirical evidence. You believe it, but without evidence. What is the definition of knowledge?
something
you believe in, but with adequate, with empirical evidence. Torah doesn't say you must have faith, you must... You know, what's interesting is, so people say, what about faith? Faith is important too, right? And isn't it true that in Genesis chapter 15, Abraham was considered righteous because of his faith? Doesn't it say that? So you see, faith is a good thing. Actually, when Christians bring up Genesis chapter 15, they make the mistake. What does it mean? That Abraham had faith that there was a God? Abraham knew there was a God. God spoke to him. He heard it. And he heard it like Dr. Shapiro, line 3. He heard it. There's no question. As a matter of fact, it tells us in Genesis chapter 26, verse 5, why was Abraham chosen to be the father of this great nation? The faith is the trusting for the future. If you're in trouble, let's say you get stuck in the airport and your car doesn't start, you need your friend, it's 4 o'clock in the morning, you just arrived in a red-eye flight, and you call your friend up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and you say, and he's half asleep, and you say, do me a favor, I'm here in the airport, and I need someone to take me home, the taxis are on strike, I need your help, right? So, do you have faith that your friend exists? Do you have faith that your friend exists? No, you have knowledge that he exists. The faith is that he's going to come through for you, the promise for the future. That's what God is saying. Look back, that's where you get your knowledge. Look forward, that's where you can have your faith. Faith means just have faith that this is true. So what makes you different than Hare Krishna? He has faith too. And why is your faith better? Because you're willing to sacrifice more faith? You have Muslims in Lebanon and Jerusalem going into a car laden with TNT and will blow themselves up to kill a few Jews. Because they're sure they have faith that they're going to go. Do you think your faith is greater than theirs? Hardly. Faith, everyone has faith. People die for all religions. It's the knowledge that makes us unique. Look back. That is why only the Torah says, you want to know what's true. It's interesting, in the most difficult parts of the Torah, it's called the Tochecha. It's the time, the period. There are two main sections for this in Leviticus chapter 26, Deuteronomy chapter 28. Terrible things it talks about the Jewish people. Very difficult things. It says one day you're going to follow other gods that your fathers didn't know. The Torah always says, look at daddy. You remember your grandfather, how he used to put on tefillin every day? It says if someone comes along with a religion that's different than daddy, don't follow. The New Testament doesn't say if someone teaches you a form of Christianity that your father didn't know, you shouldn't follow that form of Christianity. Never. You can't. Can't do such a thing. No other people could say, look at your father. You remember your Zayda? Did your Zayda, did your grandfather, did he believe in the Trinity?
Never.
So if someone comes along and says, believe in this, so think to yourself, what did my grandfather believe? What did my grandmother believe? You remember that holy woman? You remember how she would prepare Shabbos? You remember how that home would smell on Friday from gefilte fish and challah? There was a Shabbos smell there? You remember that saintly woman? It's different from what your parents believe. Don't follow it. Because only we have a transmission. Many Christians will say, wait, hold on. But I'm a Christian. My father's a Christian. Because does your father claim that his great-great-grandfather was standing there when he received 5,000 loaves of bread, when 5,000 people were fed with loaves of bread and fish? No Christian can make that claim. No Christian will say, I come from a family and we trace ourselves back to those people who saw Jesus walking on water. No. How old are you here? Are some of you here in your 60s, 70s, 50s, 40s? Is there anyone here who's 500 years old, 1,000 years old, 33. Remember how I addressed you this today as, welcome, ladies and gentlemen? It was really very silly. Ladies and gentlemen. It's arbitrary. What does ladies and gentlemen mean? The truth is that this room is probably half Jew, half Gentile. I should have addressed you that way because the Jews in this room are 3,310 years old. You are the witnesses. You are the bearers of the torch. I meet Christians, I meet Jews who become Hindus, I meet all kinds of things, and Jews come over to me, you know, and they tell me, well, you know, I had an amazing experience. They tell me this. I pray to Hare Krishna. Those Jews who get involved in New Age, they're the most elaborate miracles I've ever seen, you know. Crystals, I had unbelievable. I floated all over across Brooklyn. There's a whole... Pray to Jesus, you know. It's interesting, in Deuteronomy chapter 13, the Bible addresses this. Our sages have a very important statement, hafachba vahafachba kikulaba. Turn it again. It's all there. And Deuteronomy 13 says, what happens if a prophet or a dreamer of dreams comes over to you, Parshas Re'eh, and offers to show you a sign or a wonder? You know what that means? A sign means he foretells the future. Stock market's going to dip 350 points on Monday. He shows you a miracle, and the sign of the wonder which he told you comes to pass. The miracle happens. But then he says, let's follow other gods that your fathers didn't know. He says, don't listen to that prophet or dream of Jesus. I have not sent him, declareth the Lord. But that creates a very serious question, a dilemma here. You should all be asking the question, you should be jumping out of your seats. Why would God allow a false prophet, why would God allow a false religion to produce what seems to be miraculous experiences? We're not going to get into the fact whether they are or aren't, whether they're self-deluded, generated or not. Why would God do that? What is he doing? He's testing you. I'm only testing you to see if you really love me. If only one nation produces these spiritual, gives you goosebumps, then there's no free will any longer. And that's why it says here, look at daddy. It's a good barometer, don't you think? Someone comes along and passes you a track, you read it, say, is this what my grandfather believed? Torah says, if it's different from what your Zayda believed, stay away from it, stay far away from it. The Jewish people have a unique role, not only to be these bearers of the torch, to be the witness people, but to bring back others who are physically whole, but spiritually incomplete. Those who have physical ears, but spiritually they cannot hear. Those who have physical eyes, but spiritually they cannot see. Take a look at the bottom, a nation bears testimony, paragraph number 2. Everyone who is called to my name, this is the remnant, the righteous remnant of Israel, whom I have created for my glory, I have formed him, yes, I have made him, why? To bring out the blind people who have eyes and the deaf who have ears. And then the Bible issues a challenge to the nations of the world. Who among them could declare, let all the nations be gathered together and let the people be assembled. Let's bring the nations of the world together. Who among them can declare this and show us former things? Yes, they could show you, look how big my church is. Look how many people come to my church today. But who can point back in history? The more you move back in time and in place to Jesus, the less likely it is you're going to find anyone who believed in him. The more you move away in time and in place from Jesus, the more likely it is you're going to find people who believe in him. Look back to the original. And by the way, to take the inverted, the reciprocal version of that, take Sinai. The more you go back in time and in place to Sinai, the more likely it is you're going to find people who believe it happened. As you move back both in time and in place from Sinai, thus less likely is it going to be you're going to find people who believe in it. Look at those two structures. Look at those two models. And therefore, the Almighty challenges the nations of the world. Who can tell us, not about today, look how many radio stations you're on throughout North America. Don't tell me about what's going on today. Who from the nations of the world can tell us about former things? Who can bear testimony? Let them bring their witnesses that they may be justified, or let them hear and say, it is truth. Why? Because you are my witnesses, says the Lord, and my servant whom I have chosen, that you may know and believe me and understand that I am he. Before me there was no God formed, nor shall there be one after me. I am the Lord, and besides me, there is no Savior. I have declared and saved. I have proclaimed, and there was no foreign God amongst you. Therefore, you are my witnesses, says the Lord, that I am God. You know, there's a Hasidic tale of a Hasidic Rebbe that dies without a will, and he leaves over two children, two sons. So what happens immediately is a whole war breaks out. Who should be the next Rebbe? Big war. Three groups of Jews. One says the older son should be the Rebbe. Second group says the younger one should be the Rebbe. And the third group says, we don't want a Rebbe. Blitz, it divides the community up. There's a big war in the community. Who should be the next Rebbe? And each one wants to be the next leader of the community. And one night, in the middle of the night, suddenly the younger son starts knocking on the doors of everyone in the little shtetl, in the little chassidic community. Does everyone come? I have something unbelievable to tell everyone. Quickly, everyone come to the synagogue. I've got something unbelievable to tell you. So people are running out in their pajamas and the thing. They're running out, right? And everyone, they fill up the whole synagogue there, in this little shtetl. Everyone's filled. And everyone wonders, what is he talking about? What does he want to say? He brings all the elders, all the big knockers, all the balabatim. They're all there. Everyone's sitting there. He says, ladies and gentlemen, a wonderful thing just happened. You know, I'm sweating still. I had a dream. I had a dream, and my father, blessed be his memory, he came to me in a dream, and you know what he told me? He said, I want you to be the next Rebbe. It's all settled. So the wise men of the community stood up and said, I'm sorry. If your father wanted us to know that you are to be the next Rebbe, who would he come to? To you? No, to us. There was a national revelation at Sinai. if something came to supersede it, that now you don't have to wear tefillin, you don't have to keep Shabbos, and you're supposed to believe in the Trinity, who would this revelation be? To them, no, to us. The Almighty should have had another revelation, another national revelation saying, change, now it's Jesus. You know, you have to take a look at the language of the Bible. Turn the page, most of you have already. The page, start to remember and don't forget. And again, think about this. Again, don't be blind. Don't block out information. Torah is saying, look back. You're looking at a Torah today. Looking at a Torah today. Somebody wrote it. It didn't just... Somebody had to write it. Who were they talking to? You know, when the Bible says, remember, I want you to remember certain things. Who were the very first people to read it? Who were the first people to read it? And what were they thinking when they read for the first time? Look at section number 3. And you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. If they were never in Egypt. The Bible says in Deuteronomy 24 about ethics. You shall not prefer justice due to an alien or an orphan, nor take the widow's garment in a pledge. But you should remember that you were a slave in Egypt. Who read this for the first time? Remember, at a certain point, no one read it. At a certain point, people read it. Who were the first people to read this? Look at Remembrance of the Exodus, section 5. And Moses said to the people, remember this day. First group of people to read it. What were they? Remember this day in which you went out of Egypt from the house of slavery. And therefore tells us you shouldn't eat leavened bread, you should only eat matzah, and so why would somebody keep it if they knew that they never... Who were they speaking to? Remember, at a certain point in time, this document was not available to the public, it didn't exist, and at a certain point it was given out to the public. It happened. A certain day, it could have been a Tuesday, it could have been... But someday it happened, at a certain point, the day before, people didn't have it, the next day it's given out. And people are saying, told, remember this day. Remember the going out, look at this, remember the receiving of the Torah at Sinai, Deuteronomy 4, section 6. But take care and watch yourselves closely, so as neither to forget the things that your eyes have seen, nor let them slip from your mind all the days of your life. What are they talking about? What memories? What have you seen? Remember the journey in the wilderness, section 7. You should remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years. Who, if they didn't go 40 years? What nation would have accepted such a command? What nation would have accepted such mitzvot? What nation would have accepted such a yoke? When they're looking, if I would say to you, remember over here how this ceiling went flying in the air, and this whole building was lifted off the air, and how the fire shot around the room, and therefore I want you to live your cell life in a certain way, I want to take your television set, I want you to throw it out the window. You think I'm a nut? Nothing happened. You would only remember something if it actually happened. Who were the first people to hear this? But you know, it's interesting, we say in the Haggadah, we say Avodim Ayinu, so the Haggadah says every person is chayev, is obligated to remember that as if you were there in Egypt. You are there to be witnesses to the world. I told you, Jews in this audience, you're 3,310 years old. But the truth is, think about that. 3,300, it sounds nice. This might be adequate for a nice Sabbath sermon from a rabbi, but it's a little hyperbole here. It sounds a little extreme. I mean, come on now. I mean, it really is a little ridiculous to say you are 3,310 years old. Most of us here are, what, 50, 60, 20, 30, that's it. How could we bear testimony when we weren't there? Were you standing at Sinai? Did you hear God's voice? Do you have any memory today of standing at Sinai? No, you don't. How are we to bear witness? Because listen to me, ladies and gentlemen, there are many people that question that event. There are many people question whether this is a historical event, if Sinai really occurred. How are we to bear witness today? How can we demonstrate and prove that we were there? How can we call ourselves witnesses, really? How can we really apply this to our lives? Now, this is not the only event that is questioned in our history. There was another event that occurred about a half a century ago. Is there any person in this room that questions whether the Holocaust occurred? Is there one person in this room that questions whether... Did you know that there are people out there that question whether the Holocaust happened and insist the Holocaust never happened? They'll tell you it's a big lie. I mean, and these are not, I mean, I brought with me, I mean, there are what they call Holocaust revisionists. You have a guy, you see there, a Holocaust revisionism. Austin J. App. Who are these people? These people are men's room attendants? No. These are professors. These are people who are well educated. Former associate professor of English at LaSalle College, Philadelphia, is the author of numerous neo-Nazi pamphlets. One, for example, called "Did 6 Million Really Die? The Truth at Last." All Austin J. App. Here's another book. The book that made the Jews so mad they had to invent the movie Holocaust. Another one over here, The 6 Million Myth. Austin J. App. The 6 Million Swindle. Professor Arthur Butz, he's a professor of electrical engineering at Northwestern University, wrote one of the most well-known books on Holocaust revisionism. This is not somebody who's a, no! The Hoax of the 20th Century. It's a big book with little, very small font. So how many pages is this book here? This book here is what? 287 pages long. It's a big book. And you'll see he goes almost, bleeds it almost right to the margin with very little. It's a lot in here. The Hoax of the 20th Century. It never happened. Ferrison here, I mean, one of the most well-known, you know, Holocaust revisionists, offering money to anyone who can prove if the Holocaust happened. And by the way, you might think that maybe this is just a few fringe neo-Nazi lunatics. Some of this has infiltrated mainstream society. In Esquire magazine in 1983, Robert Mitchum, the actor, was interviewed. He was an actor. He was in Winds of War and Remembrance. I'm sure you know, right? So he was asked about the Holocaust, and they asked him, yeah. So he says, well, the Jews say there was a Holocaust. And the interview, you can see, was astonished. He says, what do you mean the Jews say? The Jews say, but isn't it a fact? He says, I don't know, there are some people that dispute this. If you take a look at what Hitler had to say about the big lie, take a look at the top of your page. The receptivity of the great masses is very limited. Their intelligence is small, but their power of forgetting is enormous. In consequence of these facts, all effective propaganda must be limited to a very few points and must harp on these in slogans until the last member of the public understands what you want him to understand by your slogan. As soon as you sacrifice this slogan and try to be many-sided, the effect will piddle away, for the crowd can neither digest nor retain the material offered. In this way, the result is weakened and the end entirely canceled out. The magnitude of a lie always contains a certain factor of credibility, since the great masses of people in the very bottom of their hearts tend to be corrupted rather than consciously and purposely evil, and that, therefore, in view of the primitive simplicity of their minds, they more easily fall a victim to a big lie than to a little one, since they themselves lie in little things. Some of you are thinking, wait, one second, hold on. But, you know, this is probably amongst Gentiles. Jews are certainly not involved in this. It's not true either. Lucy Dewitowitz, she is one of a very important writer on the Holocaust. She's a writer for the Maariv. What about Jews beginning to question? Look at the top of the page. Can all these lies change the truth? Can an honest and intelligent person believe in a criminal and absurd falsehood which claims that Nazi Germany never murdered 6 million Jews? Who can give credence to this monstrous lie that Auschwitz never housed a gas chamber? To our chagrin, these are not merely rhetorical questions. While writing this article, a young man who works on a radio program in North America approached me and asked if I would be willing to debate Robert Ferrison on the air. Robert Ferrison is, again, one of the leading Holocaust deniers today. When I replied angrily that it would be a travesty of justice and decency to give such a man a public platform, the young man answered, why are you opposed to dealing with a problem which is up for debate? He's in Israel. I asked him if, in his opinion, the murder of European Jewry was included in the category of up for debate. Has it not been proven as a historical fact? I don't know, he answered. I wasn't born yet. I'm only 30. One of the leading Holocaust revisionists today is a Jew. His name is David Cole. As a matter of fact, a few days, you know that the University of Texas, a major issue a number of years ago, the student paper published the Holocaust revisionist advertisement sent in by Smith, who's also in here. And they just faxed to me a few days ago from the Hillel an advertisement that they're asking to bring into the University of Texas. Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust offers $50,000 to the one individual instrumental in arranging a 90-minute presentation on national network television in prime time of the video of the century, a documentary on Auschwitz. David Cole interviews Dr. Piper. This authentic documentary, not a Hollywood movie, written and directed by the Jewish scholar David Cole. He's a Jewish scholar, you know, like Jews for Jews. Everyone suddenly is formally Orthodox. You notice that? Everyone suddenly, why? Because they had gefilte fish in a bar mitzvah once in Pennsylvania, an Orthodox synagogue. Suddenly is Orthodox. Everyone suddenly becomes so religious formally. Why don't we have B'nai Yeshiva? Why don't we have Yeshiva students who spent their entire lives in Yeshiva, went to Slabutka in Eretz Yisrael, went to the Mir Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael in the United States? Why aren't they getting baptized? Evangelicals say that the proof of Christendom can be demonstrated from the Torah, from the prophets, from the writings, from what they call the Old Testament. Why is it that those Jews who know nothing about the faith they're being asked to abandon are the ones... This is an old problem. Such an old problem that Paul ran around constantly. I'm a Pharisee, I'm a Pharisee, I'm a Pharisee. Why? This is a big credibility problem. So look, David Cole, who is he now? He becomes... You can look him up, by the way, on your internet. Just, you know, like in some search engine like Yahoo. Look up David Cole. You read all about him there. Written by Jewish scholars, a big Jewish scholar, David Cole, takes you inside the disputed Auschwitz gas chamber. 90 minutes. You'll get 50. Any one of you. You want to make a nice little few bucks? All you have to do is get this group to get on primetime national television to present this video. $50,000 just for making the deal. By the way, for those of you interested, and there's an organization called NIZKOR, N-I-Z-K-O-R. There's a wonderful, very, very elaborate webpage dealing with Holocaust denial. 46 important unanswered questions regarding Nazi gas chambers by David Cole. Noam Chomsky. Who is he? Puerto Rican? No, he's a Jew. He's one of the most famous professors. He's brilliant. He's a professor of linguistics at MIT. He's a radical leftist. He wrote the introduction to Ferrison's book on Holocaust revisionism. He has a history of terrible anti-Israel and so on, but he's a Jew. His father was a Hebrew linguist. So when they asked him, why did you do such a thing to write the end, he says, I believe in free speech. Everyone should be allowed, no matter how offensive the idea is, but we should never suppress free speech. Very interesting, you know, he was such a leftist, he was violently against the Vietnam War and so on. So he said that in one of his books, he writes that someone, if you allow to allow people who are for the Vietnam War, if you allow them to speak, you lose your humanity. That's what he says about the Vietnam War. If the Vietnam War, then you have to suppress free speech. If you allow someone who's for the Vietnam War to think this is a noble thing, you'll lose your humanity. But the Holocaust division, you don't lose your humanity for that. I want to ask you a question. How are we going to bring evidence that the Holocaust actually happened? Are there any Holocaust survivors in this room? How are we going to prove that the Holocaust happened? What are you going to say to me? We have survivors today. What will you do in 50 years from now? They should live and be well. There are many tens of thousands of them alive today. They should live and be well. But what are you going to do in 50 years from now, in 75 years from now? By the way, I want to ask you a question. Why is it important to prove that the Holocaust happened? Why should we bring evidence that the Holocaust happened? Why is it important to show and prove that the Holocaust actually was a historical event? Give me some ideas. Why do you think it's important that we should say the Holocaust happened? Anyone? Yeah. So it shouldn't happen again? Okay. But let's say people believe the Holocaust happened. Does that mean that there'll never be another Holocaust? And let's say we can prove it, you know what I mean? Does that mean it will happen? Why is it so important to prove that the Holocaust happened? Yes, sir?
It shows that even in white education society, it's Germany was that they can.
This man spoke brilliantly. Who were the Germans? Was this a third world country? Were these savages? Were these backward people? Who were the Austrians who willingly embraced the Anschluss? Who were they? They were uneducated people? They were uncultured. They were the most cultured people on the face of this earth. These people were all educated. They had PhDs all over, and it wasn't easy. They listened to rap music there. They listened to Bach and to Beethoven, Wagner. What was Hitler? Hitler was an idiot? No, he was a bright man and he was a talented man. He could paint beautifully. Never made it into the painting school, but he could paint. They sold his pictures not long ago. I don't know that Hitler would fail an IQ test. I don't think so. Who are these people? Who are all these revisionists? Who are they? Who are these people? Who were educated people. They were very cultured. The lesson of the Holocaust, this man is saying, is something very important. Culture and morality are completely unrelated. You can be very educated, and you could be morally depraved. Survivors describe to me how they can hear from the homes and villas around Treblinka, around Auschwitz, where the commanders lived, and you can hear beautiful violin music playing. These are very cultured people. Austria, who were they? The most cultured. Because you go to college and because you have a PhD, because you like fine music, because you like fine food, because you wouldn't walk into a McDonald's, you don't go for fast food, you only eat whatever, if you can't pronounce it, then I'll eat it. No. These are very cultured people. They love their families. They're a family men. They loved animals. Many of you have seen the picture of Hitler. He loved his German shepherd. He would roll on the floor with him. I brought with me here the trials of war criminals. This is the minutes of the Nuremberg trials, specifically the medical case. Many, many Nazis were tried for medical experiments on Jewish children, particularly on twins and special freezing and extreme cold and hot, and they did it for the airmen, so if they landed in the water, how long would they survive? On the 24th of November, 1933, Shechita was outlawed. Jewish ritual slaughter was outlawed by the Nazis as cruel to animals. We need look no further than the law which the Nazis themselves passed on the 24th of November, 1933, for the protection of animals. This law states explicitly that it is designed to prevent cruelty and indifference of man toward animals and to awaken and develop sympathy and understanding for animals as one of the highest moral values of a people. The soul of the German people should abhor the principle of mere utility without consideration of the moral aspects. The law states further that all operations or treatments which are associated with the pain or injury, especially experiments involving the use of cold, heat, or infection, are prohibited and can be permitted only under special exceptional circumstances. Special written authorization by the head of the department is necessary in every case, and experimenters are prohibited from performing experiments according to their own free judgment. Experiments for the purpose of teaching must be reduced to a minimum. Legal tests, vaccinations, withdrawal of blood for diagnostic purposes, the trial of vaccines prepared according to well-established scientific rules are permitted, but the animals have to be killed immediately and painlessly after such an experiment. They loved animals. You can love animals, you can love trees, and you can hate people. That's what it teaches us. Culture and morality are completely unrelated. What could we do to prove that the Holocaust is an actual historical event? Could somebody here help me out? What can we do? I'm sorry? Build a museum, and what will be in the museum?
Artifacts of...
Like what? Give me an example. What will be in the museum?
Clothing?
The Jews went and sewed up clothing. They rolled it in the dirt for a while and said this was in the Holocaust.
It's just some
photographs? Films, you mean photographs of what happened? Photographs? You never saw Jurassic Park? You never saw dinosaurs zetzing flying across the screen? I would submit to you, when it comes to photographs and films, that the vast majority of films that you have seen in your lives are things that have never happened. Most films are things of fiction. Most of the films you've seen are not films of things that have occurred, but things that have never occurred. You know what they can do in Hollywood today with films? You know what they can do with photographs today? Yes, sir.
Testimony of people.
You
can still work at recording all those people that...
Have testimony. What happens when the people are not alive any longer? Videotaped. But they would write down the testimony of people. Write down testimony of people, I think is very valuable. Let's say you then have, in 100 years from now, you have this scroll. Also, you have a lot of people in that, but how do you know the whole thing, 50,000 things, were not forged? One person could write 50,000. Yes?
Tell the story to your children.
Tell it over, transmit it there. But how do you know it wasn't the big lie that you're transmitting? Maybe we're just perpetrating a lie that happened. Yes?
Exchange reels that they had from those.
You're talking films. There's a young man over here that talked about films. As I said, think about the dinosaurs. Think about all the films you've seen. They could reproduce anything. White and color, make it in black and white. Yes? So the Nazis' own documents. Again, how do you know the Jews didn't forge those documents? It wasn't written by Nazis, it was written by Jews. That's what Arthur Butz claims in his book. Yes?
The Revelation, the Jews who were there said they saw the Russians who rescued us,
But they, again, they're not going to be alive at that time. The witnesses, it's true. Having witnesses testifying is certainly very important. That's primary evidence. But what do we do again in 50 or 75 years? Yes.
I don't think you really can prove it.
Oh, here's a pessimist. Can't be done. I would suggest this. To preserve the memory of the Holocaust, to preserve the teachings and ethics of what the Holocaust teaches us, the Holocaust Club needs to be formed. We need to gather together all the survivors in one place. And they have to give their testimony. They have to describe what it was like living in Poland when the Nazis came into town. What it was like in France. What it was like in Berlin and Munich when they would gather together and they had to be at a certain place at a certain time. They had to describe what it was like getting on the trains and saying goodbye to their families. What it was like on that slow trip in those cattle cars for days and days as the train was pulling a load that it was not designed for, and therefore only could travel 30 or 40 miles an hour, and the starvation and death that took place in those cars. They have to describe the thirst and the hunger, the humiliation of having to relieve themselves, drink from water that would fall from icicles. They should describe after 5 or 6 days of living in a cattle car with corpses, and finding the doors being opened and Jews get out and being whipped into lines and smelling an acrid fume and seeing smoke billow out of a chimney and being told to get into a line. And as they stood in line, how there was a man at the front of the line who would tell them if they went to the right or if they went to the left. They should describe what it was like for when they were taken and they were tattooed and how their hands swelled for days on end because of that tattooing, the blue numbers on their arms. That should describe the countless corpses they had to drag, how they had to live off the dead. When someone died, they had to take their bread. If you didn't live off the dead, you too would join them. How you had to take their clothing and put it on your clothing so that you can survive just another day. They should describe the events of what it was like living at the edge, watching the people they loved perish, what it was like living in Auschwitz, what it was like when you suddenly realized, and the rumors were going throughout the camps, that soon they were going to be liberated and the Nazis came and said, we're going on a march, what that death march was really like. And they should describe what it was like to finally meet the Soviets, the Allies, the Americans, and to be freed. They'll describe this all in a testimony, what it was like getting on a ship, going to a DP camp, and then getting on a ship to the land of Israel. This testimony should be put in a scroll. And there should be a rule in this Holocaust Club that you cannot change the scroll. The scroll is going to record the testimony of all these thousands of people, and no one can change one word. Because they're going to take the scroll, and once it's finished, once it's completed, you can't add to the scroll, and you can't take away, and anyone who does it is liable for the death penalty. And this scroll has to be stored in a special place where no one else could touch it. Every family has to have their own copy of the scroll. If you're going to be a member of the Holocaust Club, you must each have your own scroll. And only authorized scribes can write such a scroll. And every member of the Holocaust Club has to wear a yellow badge. A yellow Jewish star has to be on their clothing. And when you speak about the Holocaust, you don't speak about it in English or French, only in Yiddish. Only in the language of the Holocaust, only in the language of Eastern Europe. And in the Holocaust Club, we're going to teach our children about ethics and morality. We're going to teach people that culture, that education, the kindness to animals, that politically correct ideals. These things have nothing to do with morality. They're completely disconnected. There's no relationship between them. And not only that, every member of the Holocaust Club every morning has to put a little yellow box, and in it, a very important excerpt from the scroll has to be placed in this box. One box goes on your head and one box goes on your arm. Every member of the Holocaust Club, as a baby, as soon as the baby is born, a little tattoo is put on the arm of the number of that family. A segment of the Holocaust scroll has to be read every evening before every member of the Holocaust Club goes to sleep and before they wake up in the morning. And it goes like this. Here, O members of the Holocaust Club, remember and never forget the Holocaust happened to us. Every member of the Holocaust Club once a week goes on strike. They don't work. Instead, they come to special Holocaust Club gathering halls where they discuss the scroll. They take the entire Holocaust scroll. It's huge. It's enormous testimony. And they divide it up into 52 sections. And once a week, they read a portion from that Holocaust scroll. There's no intermarriage permitted amongst the Holocaust Club. You cannot marry someone who is outside of the club. You cannot allow someone who is not part of the club to marry someone who's a member of the club. It will lessen the message. It'll water it down. It will dilute it. We will permit new members to join the club, but we're going to make it tough. They have to be sure that they're going to commit their lives to transmitting the message of the Holocaust Club. We do not allow just people to pop up and jump, I want to be in, we're going to sprinkle them with water. No. They have to be people who will take a vow, and when they become members of the club, they too must get the tattoo on their arm. There'll be three special holidays throughout the year. The first holiday, it'll be a holiday where they'll think about what the survivors had to do and endure. On this holiday, you'll have to eat potato peels and you're going to dip it in puddle water. You'll eat it with stale bread. No fresh bread could be eaten during this holiday. You cannot wear regular clothing on that holiday. You have to wear the concentration camp clothing with gray and white stripes going down. You have to pass it down to your children. You have to do these things so your children will ask, why are you doing it? And you'll tell them, because you are a member of the Holocaust Club. Never forget it. We're living the Holocaust. There'll be a second holiday where everyone gets on ships. We're going to record how the Jewish people, how the Holocaust survivors after the DP camps went to the land of Israel. And they went by ship. So for 7 days, all the members of the Holocaust Club, they don't stay home, they close their houses up, and they go on a ship to reenact the going to the land of Israel after the Holocaust. And there'll be a third holiday, and that third holiday will commemorate when the club was formed, when the scrolls were written, the gathering, all the recording of the testimony. That night of the third holiday, we're going to stay up all evening, all night till the morning, and study the scrolls. We're going to teach our children. Do you understand now? Now let me ask you a question. If we have millions of people living the scroll, but you see a million people living a bizarre life, you say they're crazy people, but you see they have a scroll that attests to the people. If you only had a scroll, you'd say some idiot wrote it, it was a forgery. You have millions of people that are living the scroll. The scroll attests to the people, and the people attest the scroll. Yisrael b'yoyraisa kudusha b'richu chadhu. I believe that's what it means. Yisrael b'yoyraisa, the nation of Israel and the Torah, chadhu, they're one. Each attests to the other. The nation attests to the scroll attests to the people. I want you to know that what I've said to you is not bizarre. There was a world gathering of Holocaust survivors in June of 1981. It really began with a very special man who I had the opportunity of the last few days to speak with, moreover, to listen to. His name is Ernest Michel. Ernest Michel is a man who's a survivor of Auschwitz. He describes how in 1943 he was in Auschwitz. It was Passover. They had no matzah in Auschwitz. They had no wine in Auschwitz, but they had a dream. They had a dream of freedom. They had a dream of redemption. He described this in a wonderful book called Promises to Keep. And the dream was that if somehow, some way, they would survive this hell, they would have a world gathering where they would bring survivors together. In 1981, in Jerusalem, there was the gathering of Holocaust survivors. I'm sure many of you here remember that. It was an extraordinary event. About 10,000 survivors came together. Ernest Michel spoke on the first night. He spoke at Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Israel. This was his speech. My name is Ernest Michel. Auschwitz number 104995. Like many of you, I had a dream that one day, if we live, we could come and stand together. This is a reunion of a special group of people for which there was no parallel anywhere. We want to stand together once more before time runs out. United in freedom as we were in slavery. We want to see in each of others' eyes and in the eyes of our children the proof of our survival and the joy that comes from being alive and free. But there is more than that. We survivors want to tell those who try to rewrite history and deny that the Holocaust ever happened. Our eyes have seen, our ears have heard, our nostrils were filled with the acrid fumes of the gas chambers drifting over our camp. Day after day, week after week, year after year, these hands, he holds up his hands to the audience, have carried more corpses than I care to remember, so don't tell us it never happened. We were there. This gathering could not have taken place 10 or 20 years ago. It took time for wounds to heal enough for us to meet. This is why this event took place almost 40 years to come into being, and that is why we shall never meet again as one group. it has become fashionable to invoke the memory of the Holocaust. So much has been written, so much has been dramatized. It is we who have lived it, we who have survived it, we of whom they write, we of whom they speak. So today it is our turn. Today we speak. Despite the memories of the past, we have built new lives. Many of us have second families. So many of the first were exterminated. We have children, grandchildren. We have sanctified the names of those we lost. We have contributed to the Jewish tomorrows. A number of people have asked, why are you doing this? Why do you want to meet? Why recall a past such as you've had? Why not leave it alone? Our response, straight and simple, we survive for a purpose. Already something constructive has emerged from this gathering. Represented here are almost 1,000 members of the second generation. I am pleased to announce that they have formed here in Jerusalem a second generation international network whose major purpose will be to carry on the memory of the Holocaust. Like you, I will never forget this week, the seeking, the finding, then that first look of recognition. Aren't you? Aren't you? Weren't you? Block 14, Commando 35 from the ghetto. They produce a remembrance document. This day, the 16th of Sivan, 5741, in this 36th year of our liberation from the hands of the Nazis, we are all standing before the remnant of our sanctuary in Jerusalem to transmit the legacy of this generation to future generations to come. We are members of the generations which lived through the Holocaust. One of a city, two of a family survived. Ours is the generation of our children. They are standing here with us today, children without grandparents. The memory of the 6 million burnt in the fires of the Holocaust is with us here as we transmit our everlasting legacy. Remember and let nothing be forgotten. Remember what evil men did to us. Remember we are a people scattered and dispersed among the nations in all countries. Forget not. Let every Jew view himself as though he had been scorched in the fires of the Holocaust, for the obligation lies on him to remember and not to forget, to turn memory into action, to restore the life and culture of our people. Menachem Begin was there, and he spoke that evening. It was a Thursday evening. It was the closing ceremony at the wall. 6,000 memorial candles, 1,000 people per candle. 6 million, this was the evening of the future, the transmission of the legacy. In 6 languages, Hebrew, Yiddish, English, French, Ladino, and Russian, a survivor read the legacy, and the son or grandson of survivor received it. For 45 minutes, 10,000 people sat in perfect silence, and as an Israeli, an Australian, a New Yorker, a Parisian, another Israeli survivor read in each of the 6 languages. Remember what the German killers did to our people. Remember them with rage and with contempt. Remember what an indifferent world did to us and to itself. Ladies and gentlemen, I think you've figured it out by now. This was a model, but I want you to know something. There was another gathering that took place 3,300 years ago, and yes, you are the bearers of the torch. There was a gathering of survivors on the 14th year. Look at paragraph number 8 in the 14th year, the first day of the 11th month, Moses spoke to the people of Israel according to all that the Lord had given him in commandment to them. Today you are all standing before the Lord your God, the heads of your tribes, your elders. The testimony, take a look at the second paragraph. And Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, you have seen all the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt. Look where it's underlined. Verse 4, I have led you for 40 years in the wilderness. Your clothes have not worn out upon you, and your sandals have not worn off your feet. Who is he talking to? Did this happen? Did this occur? I want you to pay very careful attention to section number 10. Look at these two paragraphs, because, again, I want you to now think, everything's at stake here. This document comes into existence at a certain point. People hear it for the first time. The Torah wants to forewarn any possibility that it was invented earlier or later. The first generation hear this. Now look at this over here. The first generation here, first of all, notice something. Whoever receives is told, did you notice that your forefathers don't have this document, only you do? That I didn't make this document with your fathers, but with you? And then the next paragraph will say, did you notice that this was not made with your children? Look at section 10, the eyewitness accounts. This first text is from Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 1 through 3. And Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, hear, O Israel, the statutes and the ordinances which I speak in your hearing this day, and you shall learn them and be careful to do them. the Lord your God made a covenant with us at Horeb. Horeb is Sinai. Now, tell me what you make of verse 3. Not with our fathers did the Lord make this covenant, but with us, who are all of us here alive this day. The Lord spoke with you face to face at the mountain, out of the midst of the fire. Again, who is hearing this for the first time? When did this come into being? Which generation hears this? The generation is being told, I didn't make this with your fathers. They're not the ones who saw this. It is you. Look at the next paragraph, Deuteronomy chapter 11, verse 2 through 7. You must now realize that I'm not speaking with your children who do not know, who do not see the lesson the Lord your God taught through his greatness and his mighty hand and his outstretched arm. Look at the last verse, verse 7. Your eyes have seen the very great act of the Lord which he did. Who's hearing this for the very first time? Mission section 11, transmission to future generations. But this is not with you alone that I'm making this covenant oath. I'm making with both those who are standing here today, with us before the Lord your God, and those who are not yet here with us. Writing the legacy, Moses finished writing the words of this Torah in the scroll to the very end. Prohibition of change, you can't change it. Do not add to the word that I'm commanding you. Do not subtract from it. You must keep all the commands of the Lord your God, which I'm instructing you. Can't change it. You know, look at us here, Jewish people, Gentiles. I mean, all of us here probably been to a synagogue in our lives. Many of us spent all of our lives going to a synagogue. And those are similarities we have. Let's talk about differences. We have Jewish people in this room who identify as Orthodox, conservative, Reform, maybe Reconstructionist. There are Jews here from all over the world. Think about the Torah. If we went to a synagogue, an Orthodox synagogue here in Dallas, and we went to a Reform synagogue, and we opened the Torah scrolls, how many differences would we find between those scrolls? Zero. Maybe if we went to a synagogue in Australia and another one in South Africa, how many differences would we find?
Zero.
Would it make a difference if they were Reformed, conservative, Orthodox congregation? It makes no difference at all. By the way, how many differences are there in the New Testament in the manuscripts? How many variant manuscripts are there, Greek manuscripts in the New Testament? Anyone want to venture to guess? Not even close. This is a book written by one of the most famous Christian apologists alive today. He's one of the most well-known. Anyone know what a Christian apologist is? It doesn't mean someone walks around going, I'm sorry, forgive me, excuse me, I'm sorry, forgive me. An apologist is a defender. He's a defender of Christianity. What I'm trying to communicate to you is this Josh McDowell in his book, Evidence of Man's Verdict. This is not a person who is someone who's pro-Jewish, who wants to disprove Christianity. The purpose, Evidence that Demands a Verdict, is the whole book is dedicated to proving the truth, the veracity of Christianity. That's what this book is. We understand, where is it coming from? Korn and Geisler and Nix make the following comment about how textual variations in the New Testament are counted. There is an ambiguity in saying that there are some... You ready? How many are you guessing? 200,000 variants in the existing manuscripts in the New Testament. But it's an ambiguity. It doesn't 200,000. Doesn't really. He's going to show why this is 200. Don't get so upset. Why not? Why? Since these only represent 10,000 places in the New Testament. What does that mean? It's only 10,000. Because if one single word is misspelled in 3,000 different manuscripts, this counts as 3,000 variants of reading. So it's not. It's only 10,000. But 10,000 also doesn't sound so good, right? They concluded that actually, of all the variant manuscripts, only 400 of them create doubt as to the textual meaning of the text. And only 50 of these are of great significance. And actually, only 50. Yeah. Big deal. By the way, I want to ask you a question here. I've been asking you a lot of questions. Can anyone think of, so we have this incredible uniformity in the Torah. The Torah says this is an eternal document. Can anyone give me, if we take God out of the picture, can anyone give me a logical reason why it should be the other way around? Why we should find logical reasons, sociological, whatever reasons, why the Torah should be many variant manuscripts and why the New Testament should be quite uniform? Can anyone explain to me a counter reason why it should be the other way around? Anyone? Give me a reason.
In your document.
Oh, very good. The first thing is the New Testament simply has not been around as long as the Jewish scriptures. So simply it's more to go wrong with the document that's been around for 3,300 years. That one's been around for 1,900 years. There's more time for things to go wrong. Very good. Anything else? Give me another reason why we would anticipate the reverse. We should find enormous uniformity amongst the New Testament, not amongst the Jews.
The Jewish document started in a single language, and the Christian document in many languages.
Well, yeah, but it did start in the Greek language, but again, the Hebrew was dominant at the time. All right, anything else? Yes?
Supposedly less people were involved writing it.
In the what?
The New Testament.
Less people involved writing the Testament than the Torah, you mean? You mean according to those who are the whole talk? I wouldn't say that. How about this one? I'd say, let me ask you a question. Let's say you have a scribe here in Dallas, in Fort Worth, right? And he decides to change one word. Let's say he takes out a word. What are you going to do about it? Nothing. There's nothing you can do. We don't have any central authority that could punish someone or make sure that that Torah does not get out. But if for a very long time had someone touched one word of the New Testament, changed one piece of what the church considered sacred, the church had no problem burning you at the stake for doing that. Who could touch it? If someone, I mean, let's be, well, let me be politically incorrect. We have in New York a synagogue called Simchat Torah, right? It's a synagogue that serves the gay and lesbian community, right? So they'll find a verse in Leviticus. It's not very pleasant, right? That's difficult. So let's say they'll take it out. They'll have one written to take it out. What are you going to do? You can't do a thing.
What about the thing that it's not considered kosher and it's not all there?
Right. It's not considered kosher, but so what if you don't consider it kosher? So what? Let's say I don't like your... Who will throw it out? But that synagogue can keep it and then sort of to transmit it. And other synagogues will adapt it. Remember, you're right, the Jewish people are not this monolithic group which agreed on everything. We have a lot of difficult internal problems. Most Jews complain about that to me all the time. They say, Jew, why are we so divided? We don't agree. That's what Jews say. Most Jews, I find, are for Jewish unity. As long as we do it my way, but there's Jewish unity. They're one Jewish unity, they're for Jewish unity, they like Jewish unity. You know, when the Torah was given to us at Sinai, I'll show you how detailed it is. When the Torah was given to us at Sinai, so there are certain words we were taught that are to be written in the scroll a certain way, but they're not to be read that way. They're not to be heard that way. They're not to be spoken that way. It's called the Kri and Ksiv. Do you understand this? You'll turn a couple of pages. I'll show you how extreme this is. Just turn to your last page, just for momentarily. You see it on top of Kri and Ksiv? That means we were taught that we are to write something in the scroll this way, but there are reasons, which I'm not going to go into right now, if you'll ask, I'll talk, but there are reasons why we are taught at Sinai that it's to be written in the scroll this way, but when you read it, you have to read it differently. Now, what I did was I went to the Torah, and I took something that at first glance appears very insignificant difference. Look at Genesis 36, verse 5. V'halivama, now we're talking about Esau's children. If I would ask you who Yeush is, would you know who it is? Most people would not know. Who's Yeush? He does not play a big role in the Jewish Bible. He was one of the sons of Esau. One of the sons. And you see over there? Now, it's interesting that you see there's the word there in Hebrew, it's to be written. You see what is to be written? It's written as if you would say Yeush, right? But it's to be read as if it says Yeush, which is a verb. Look at the two gray boxes and you'll see them side by side. In a Torah scroll, it's read as Yeush, that means Yud, Ayin, Yud, Shin. But you're not the Torah reader. If he would pronounce it the way it says, they would scream at him. He's not allowed to read it that way. There's a Kri, which means it has to be read Yeush. This is the oral Torah tells us that. By the way, the King James agrees with every one of our oral Torahs. You look at the King James, you'll see there, it says his name is Yeush. The King James would never dare play with this, but they don't really believe in the oral law. It's an amazing thing. So what would happen? So I'm taking the most insignificant thing here you can imagine. So look at the bottom box in the middle there. Let's say a scribe, you see the difference in a Yud and a Vav? Not terribly significant. So let's say you have one scribe who by accident, instead of making it a Yud, the second Yud, he would make it a Vav by accident. But in reality, he's doing us a favor because now it reads the way it sounds. What do we have to do with that Torah if it has a Vav, it has instead of a Yud a Vav? What do we have to do with that Torah? We have to correct. We can correct it. If he made a mistake by accident and he puts by accident a Vav instead of a Yud, are you allowed to read from it? Are you allowed to use it in the synagogue? No, it has to be Zvit. Closed up, and they put a special ring around the outside of it, so you know this is a puzzle of Sefer Torah. It is a invalid Torah. By the way, what happens if a sofer, if a scribe is a very smart guy, says, look, why we read it that way, why not write it that way already? So all the people who read from in the Torah won't make a mistake, so I'll put the Vav there instead of the Yud. What do you have to do with the Sefer Torah? What is halach? What does Jewish law say that if a person intentionally changes one letter, what do you have to do with it? Does anyone know what the halach law is? You have to burn it. A Torah that's intentionally changed, you have to burn it with God's name in it, with the tetragram in it, with Yud Kei Vav Kei in it, with God's holy name in it. A book that if you drop it, you have to fast for 40 days. But if a person changes one letter in it intentionally, you have to burn it. That's a Jewish law. Now you're beginning to understand. Parents to children, section 16, teach your children, speak to them when you're at home, when traveling on the road, when you lie down, and when you get up. Foundations of morality, remember, we have to teach this. We read this before. Do not pervert justice for the proselyte, for the convert or the orphan. You must remember that you were a slave in Egypt. Weekly, that's of course Shabbos. You come together, observe the Shabbos, and keep it holy. Once a week, you have to quit if you go on strike. And you study the scroll. 1/52nd of the scroll had to be read for those who belong to the Holocaust Club. The number sign on the body, where you know, this is my covenant between me and you, between you and your offspring, that you must keep. You must circumcise every male. You shall be circumcised with the flesh of your offspring. Special garments. Remember the yellow badge with the Star of David? God spoke to Moses, telling him to speak to the Israelites and to have them make tassels on the corners of their garments for all generations. They shall include a twist of sky blue thread. Turn the page. Excerpts from the scroll on the head and the heart. You remember that in yellow boxes? These words shall be to you as a sign on your hand, as a memorial between your eyes. Excerpts from the scroll on the doorposts. Write them on parchment and affix to the doorposts of your houses and gates. Membership sanctions. Do not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons. Do not take their daughters for your sons. Yearly family gathering. Transmission to the next generation. When your son asks you in time to come, what is the meaning of the testimony and the statutes and the ordinances? It's interesting. If someone invented this, the national revelation concept, someone invented this whole idea. It means that one of the committees invented. Someone had to invent. It didn't happen. Someone invented it. It's either two. Couldn't be true. It either was invented or it actually is a historical event. So let's take the possibility it was invented. So if someone invented it, so they'll say, you know what? There was a national revelation. So what question, sir, are you going to ask if someone says, do you know there was a national revelation in Dallas? Everyone in Dallas was there 50 years ago and heard God's voice. What are you going to ask? Really? How come no one told me? So they'll say to you, it was forgotten. They took a promise not to tell anyone. Whoever writes this document says this. You want to know about the going out of Egypt? You want to know about the national revelation? Sha'al avicha v'yagedcha zikeinecha v'yomilach. Ask daddy. He'll tell you. That's why Seder table, we have children there. Ask your father. He'll tell you about it. Ask your father about the Trinity. Ask see if Zaidi worship these things. Ask daddy. But if you invented it, why are you sending people to your parents for it? The parents know nothing about it. You invented it. Think about that. Commemoration of deliverance. Remember that? Only stale bread, no fresh bread, potato peels dipped in puddle water. You shall eat no leavened bread with it. 7 days shall you eat unleavened bread. Commemoration of the traveling to the promised land by ship. You shall dwell in booths for 7 days, all that are native. We just finished Sukkot. Commemoration of the founding of International Network. I want to bring this to a close by reading to you a speech. See if you know who made this speech. About 300 years ago, a ship set sail for the New World, and its name was the Mayflower. Its passengers were Englishmen who had become disgusted with their government and their society. They set out in search of some deserted shore to establish a new life for themselves. They landed in America, and they were the first founders of that land and that people. This was an important event in the history of both England and America. And for this reason, to this day, every American child knows of the Mayflower, the Pilgrims, Plymouth Rock, and November 25th, Thanksgiving Day. I am, however, very interested in knowing if any Englishman, or American for that matter, is aware of the hour and the day that the Mayflower set sail. Does any child or even adult know how many pilgrims there were on this historical voyage? What were the names of their families? What did they wear? What did they eat? Where did they get water to drink? What path did they navigate? And what happened en route? Behold, it was more than 3,300 years ago that the Jews set out from Egypt. Every Jewish child all over the world, in America, Soviet Russia, Yemen, and Germany, knows exactly how his ancestors left at dawn on the 15th day of Nisan. What did they wear? Their loins were girdled with, and their sandals were on their feet, and their staffs were in their hands. The They muttled and they arrived at the Red Sea after a 7-day journey. These children also know the route that their ancestors traveled and what events transpired during their 40-year trek in the wilderness. They ate manna and quail. They drank water from the well of Miriam. They arrived at the borders of the Promised Land on the banks of the Jordan River facing Jericho. They know the names of their ancestors and they ate and can quote them to you from the 5 books of Moses. Till this day, Jews the world over eat the same matzot for 7 days, starting from the 15th of Nisan each year. And they relate the story of the Exodus and the tribulation that the Jews have suffered from the day they left their land and wandered into exile. And they end by shouting 2 phrases that children and parents and grandparents have been saying for thousands of years. Now we are slaves. Next year we will be free men. Now we are here in exile. Next year we will be in Jerusalem, in the land of Israel. This is the nature of the Jews. Ladies and gentlemen, who made that speech? The year was 1948. The person who made that speech was Ben-Gurion, David Ben-Gurion. Hardly someone who might be considered a very observant Jew. He stood in front of the Anglo-American Investigation Committee of the United Nations and made that speech. I want to end this program with, you know, the story of the fellow who, this happens to a lot of people, we've just seen the stock market fluctuate quite a bit this week. Some of us, I see, have more gray hairs this time than the last time I was here. You know the story of the guy, your friend Henry, good friend, calls you up on the phone. He says, listen, Sam, I got a plan for you. I've got this tip in the stock market. I'm putting in $10,000. My tip says that this stock is going to double by tomorrow in value. Would you invest with me $10,000 of your own money? So you go, look, you know, I'm really not into this. I like to sell, stay with things that are more stable. I don't get involved in the stock market. You know this, Henry. Leave me alone. Go ahead. So you get off the phone. You're like a little wondering, isn't that interesting? So the next day, of course, the next thing you do immediately is you open up the newspaper and look up the stock and look at that. It doubled in value, just as Henry said. Impressive. Boy, I got lucky. Right? Well, the next night you get another phone call. Sam gets a second phone call. What happens? Who's on the phone? Henry. He says, look, I have another tip for you. I have a tip. This other stock is going to double in value. I'm investing my $20,000. We invest your $10,000. He said, look, Henry, I told you I don't get involved in this. You know, it's an easy come, easy go. I don't get involved in stock. It's not... You know, I said, please. He says, try the... No. So he gets on the phone. Well, what does Sam do the next day? Next day, right away, he didn't want it, but he right away opens up the New York Times and bingo, what's that? Boom, look at that. Henry's stock doubled in value again. You know? Now you get another phone call, right? The next day, Henry calls up again. This time, Sam doesn't want to answer the phone. He leaves the volume of the answer machine on high. Right? You ever do this? I'm not answering. I see what my caller ID says. I'll just listen. And the voice always goes like this. I know you're listening. Doesn't that happen? And your heart is zetting everyone. I know you're there. Pick up now. We go, oh, God, right. And suddenly we think story is starting to go to the head. Okay, I was here. I was picking up a tuna fish sandwich. That's why I wasn't here. And you're sitting there, you're looking like you're transfixed on this answering machine, right? I know you're listening. Pick up, you idiot. And said, all right, I'll say it anyway. Tomorrow this stock is going to double in value. Invest. I'm putting my $80,000 into it. Would you invest your, you know? Henry is going to move. God, I'm not going to do it. So it says click. And sure enough, what does he do? Sam do the next day. Right away goes to the New York Times and look at that over here. It's the double. Now Henry has a portfolio of $160,000. And Sam has $10,069.81 because the CD created annuities. And, right? Well, the phone rings again. Caller ID kicks on. He says, no way I'm taking this phone call, right? I know you're there again, Sam. Invest with me now. I got another tip. This stock is going to double in value. Put in your $10,000. I'm putting in my $160,000. Please do it. This is the stock. Call now the broker up. And you're saying, that, oh, God, I can't get involved now. I know it's going to collapse now. What happens? Sure enough, the next day, Sam runs and opens up the New York Times, and what happens? It doubles. So now what happens? Now Henry has a portfolio of $340,000, and Sam has $10,000, right? So then what happens next? So then he gets another phone call, and then, you know, Henry says, hey, listen over here. I know you're not answering your phones. You're not taking phone calls from anyone. I try calling you from the telephone booth, and you still don't answer. You bum. You're not answering any phone calls. It says invest in this stock, and if you invest in this stock, you're going to have, it's going to double in value. And by this, by the way, by this time, we sort of suspect that, is Henry guessing? I don't think so. Okay, it's called insider information here, right? And Henry is going, you know, go and invest. And Sam says, forget about it, no way, right? But the next day, his Henry's stock, again, he looks it up, and again, look at that. Henry's stock is now $650,000, right? Yours is $10,000, right?
$720.
When it comes to money, you pay attention. Isn't that interesting? I'm seeing Jews with calculators here. They're very angry. What did you say? I saw that 340. It's going to be on the tape. You're going to be finished.
Minus commission.
That's it. They're figuring the commission over here. They're the Jews. They know. They're working it all out. I have six people there with pencils and papers. They're working it out. Some two guys are calling the secretaries in. Henry gives another call. Sam, he says, Sam, listen to me. Invest again. I'm investing my $640,000. Invest your $10,000. And Sam goes, this is the time. I know it's going to plunge now. And, of course, the next day, of course, it doubles in value. Sam now has a portfolio that $10,000. And Henry now has a portfolio worth $1,280,000. And now Henry comes to Sam's tenement in his Ferrari. He pulls up to the front and he goes upstairs and he goes to Henry. Henry goes over to Sam and said, you remember when I called you for that very first time? And when I called you up and I said, I'm investing my $10,000, will you invest your $10,000? I knew you wouldn't invest. So what I did was I took a second $10,000 and I created a portfolio for you. While my $10,000 was doubling and doubling, I put my $10,000 aside for you, and your portfolio, too, was doubling. You, too, now have a portfolio worth $1,280,000. Are you going to invest now? That's what we're saying to you. Listen to me. Some Jewish people are standing here and saying, look, I've lived my life, and I've not lived my life by this Torah. I've abandoned its teachings. I don't deserve to be a part of it now. We here have been investing that money for you. We've been investing. The portfolio is there for you. It'll be the same as every other Jew who's holding it all his life. Are you ready to invest now? Are you ready to put in just your $10,000? You are the bearers of the torch. Thank you for being here tonight. Thank you.